So I guess I was asked to go and talk about the book and then also at the end talk about the bailout stuff. I mean, I could go do a whole talk on the bailout, I suppose, if that's what you want. But the you know, the market, people are constantly pointing to failures. You just have to listen to the debates or talks this year, and you hear constant references to greed on Wall Street, and I don't think Barack Obama's seen a government regulation that he doesn't like, and you know, we hear it all the time from price gouging by gasoline companies. It seems like virtually every change that occurred over the last year in terms of oil prices was due to some changes in collusion that were occurring among the gasoline companies. You hear about price gouging by pharmaceutical companies. Surely one of the first things they're going to do this next year is put price controls on pharmaceutical products. And you could go down the list of things that people are concerned about and complaining about the market. I'm not going to go and argue the market's perfect. I'm sure there's lots of times that people go and buy things and wish afterwards that they hadn't bought them. The problem is that isn't the right standard to go and pick, because often the game seems to be, will people make perfect decisions under the market? And if the answer seems to be no, then the response seems to be, well, we need some type of government intervention or regulation in order to solve the problem. And the issue is that just as it's easy to go and point to failures that exist in the market, it's also very easy to go and point to failures that exist in the government. In fact, I would argue in many cases the problems are at least as large with regard to the government handling issues as they are with the market. And so the question is, which is more costly, which is better able to go and solve the problem, not simply can I go and identify some type of market failure that exists there. And one of the things just to keep in mind, though, is when people have their own money at stake, they can be pretty inventive in terms of finding solutions to problems that that exist. And the bigger you claim the market failure is, what that often means is the bigger the profit opportunities are for people to go and figure out some way of trying to go and solve that problem. And what I like to do is go and give you a few examples on the market failure type issues, then go and talk about a couple examples with economics, just how it applies to things you might normally not think about applying to, and then spend maybe the last 10 minutes or 15 minutes talking about the bailout issues right now. But to me, economics boils down to one simple idea, and that is, if something's more costly, you do less of it. Or conversely, the greater the returns, the more you'll do of it. And to me, what got me interested in economics to begin with was just how that one simple idea can really explain just so many different phenomena out in the world, from the impact of campaign finance regulations to why the rate of adoptions fell so dramatically during the 1970s. But first, let's go through some examples with so-called market failure. And one of the things I'm sure you all have heard about, particularly if you've bought a car or thought about buying a car, is the notion that as soon as you buy a new car and you take it off the new car lot, it's going to go and fall in value. Some people can't claim 20, 25%. In fact, if you've taken the law and econ class and they deal with asymmetric information, it's very likely that's going to be one of the very first examples that they're going to go and give you in the law and economics class. And the claim is that what happens is something called Lemon's problem. And the type of people who are likely to buy a new car and then quickly resell it are people who are going to somehow fundamentally be unhappy with the car. That they're very likely, much more than sellers of cars that are 2 or 3 or 4 years old, have some innate problem with the car, some type of Lemon's issue. And if the claim goes, people who are trying to buy the car can't figure out what the true value of the car is. Even I buy a car for $20,000, I put a couple thousand miles on it, I try to resell it. Well, should be pretty close to $20,000 if it's not one of these problematic cars that are there. And yet, the claim is that all these cars, as soon as I take them off the lot, they're going to have this big drop. And the claim is that customers just can't differentiate the quality of you know, the true underlying quality of the car from this fear that they have that this could go and possibly be a lemon. But, you know, one thing just to think about, if it really does fall by $4,000 or $5,000, what does that tell you is the profit opportunity you have for going and solving that information problem that's there? That means you can make up to $4,000 to $5,000 figuring that out. And so what you're really saying is if you believe that the price of the car is going to be falling by $4,000 to $5,000, that means you believe that for $4,000 or $5,000, I can't figure out some way of trying to convince you that this car is really worth as much as it is. Now, it doesn't take a lot of imagination, I don't think, to go and think about ways that we can go for presumably a lot less than $4,000 or $5,000, trying to go and convince people what the true underlying value of a car is, right? I mean, you got your local mechanic nearby who could go and do a check. I mean, how much is that going to cost? But it's not just the individual who's going to have bought the car and trying to resell it that has an interest in trying to figure out and trying to convince future buyers what the true value of the car is. And why is that? The original seller, you know, whether it's Toyota or Ford or General Motors or Mercedes or whoever it is, they care about trying to figure out a way of solving this type of information problem. And the reason why the original seller does, even though they're not involved directly in this next sale of the car, the reason why they care about it is because how much they can sell the price of the car for is directly related to how much you can sell it for later on. I mean, if I tell you as soon as you drive this car off the lot, it's going to fall by $5,000 in value, or if I tell you it's going to retain its value and you're going to be able to sell it for virtually the same price that you just bought it for, how much is that going to affect how much you're going to pay for it to begin with? Of course it is. And so, you know, the original makers of the car can do things like they can go and offer, you know, 120-point inspection on the car where they could certify this car, saying that this is a certified used car and that there's, you know, they guarantee with their reputations that it's not a problematic car. So you just don't, there's other ways that this could be solved too. You have warranties. Well, maybe one reason why you have transferable warranties that are there, so that the guy who buys it is just as protected from any type of lemons problem as the person who had the car to begin with this. But, you know, fortunately, it's pretty easy just to go out and check to see whether or not this is the type of information problem, this asymmetric information that people fear. I mean, one thing you can do is you have things like Kelley Blue Book or Kelley Black Book, which have amazingly detailed information on cars. You know, just not just the manufacturer's suggested retail price of the car, but you know the actual transaction price that the car sold for when it was new, not just what the posted price was for the car. And you know, you can look at the age of the car, the number of miles that are on it, measures of the quality of the car, condition it's in. You can also go and look at all sorts of different types of prices when it's resold. What's the private transfer price? What's the price if you were to trade it in? And so you could go and look at, for example, what the actual sale price is and when it was purchased brand new, and what's the private transfer price. And if you look at cars that are only a few months old and have only a few thousand miles on it, you find that they fall by about 3%. You know, not this 20 or 25% fear price that drop that people have. Let me give you another example, quite different example of claim market failure. But, you know, first, the point that I just wanted to make in that, just to make sure it's clear, is that the bigger the gain, or the bigger the market failure, the bigger the gain that somebody had to go and try to figure out and make money trying to solve it. And when you're claiming that there's a big market failure, you're making some type of assumption about how costly it is for somebody to go and solve that. And at least it's useful as an internal gut check whether you really believe it's that costly or not for somebody to solve that problem. Now, another example. Does anybody know what LoJack is? These little devices that are about between the size of a quarter and a half dollar that you can go and hide someplace on your car. And what happens is if a car gets stolen, the police can turn on a little radio signal that will turn on a tracking beacon that emanates from this device. And then they can triangulate on the car, and maybe after 2 or 3 days, they'll go and find the car and be able to go and get it back. There's some academic research out there that claims that for each 1% of cars that have LoJack devices on them, you'll reduce auto theft rates by about 23%. But there's an interesting puzzle. And the puzzle is this, that if you look around the country where you have auto insurance regulations, basically every place, a number of states mandate that the insurance companies give discounts on those cars that install LoJack devices. Some states like New York mandate 15%. There are other states that mandate 10 or 5. And there's a number of states that don't mandate any discount. But the interesting thing is that whenever these states' insurance bureaus mandate a discount, the insurance companies fight tooth and nail against having that discount being offered. And when you go and you look across the states, when it's a 15% required discount, that's the discount they give, not a penny more. When it's 10%, 10% is what they give. When it's 5%, they give 5. And when there's no mandated discount, they don't give, the vast majority of insurance companies don't give any discount on doing that. So why is that? Well, there are a couple arguments that have been offered. One is that, insurance companies, they don't want to go out and have everybody use LoJack devices because nobody's going to steal cars, and then that's going to mean nobody's going to want to buy auto insurance. I'm not really going to spend any time on that one. But an argument that might be at least something to think about a little bit more is that there's this externality type issue. And the claim is that, well, there's a private benefit for having LoJack on. You get the car back. But there's a public benefit, and that is the auto thieves don't know when they go and try to steal a car whether that car has LoJack on it or not. And so you're producing benefits for others. And the people who did this original research claimed that each LoJack device that was installed produced a net benefit or a benefit of $5,000 in terms of reduced auto theft sales, auto thefts. And 90% of that, they claimed, was public benefit, and 10% was private. But that's still $500. That's still, a device may cost $600, but you still would give them some payoff for doing that, presumably. And yet the insurance companies don't want to do that. So it may not explain why you don't give a $5,000 payoff. The insurance company won't subsidize them that much for putting the device on. But you at least think they should give some. It doesn't explain why they don't give at least some discount for that. But think about this externality problem for a second. Is there any ways you can think of that can solve this externality problem? Is it really an externality? I mean, and this isn't the only type of crime-type situation you have externality-type cases, something that I've done work on, concealed carry laws. You can go and argue of a similar case, possibly, that a criminal, in Virginia you have like 200,000 people with concealed handgun permits. A criminal doesn't know when they go and attack somebody whether that person's able to go and defend themselves. And if the fact that somebody may be able to defend themselves can deter criminals, even people who may never even think of owning a gun could possibly benefit from the fact that there are other people out there who are able to defend themselves. But there's a big difference there. There, we actually tax people, make them pay a fee for getting the permit. We don't go and subsidize them. And it's not like we're having to go and mandate a subsidy over the objections of the individuals involved in the LoJack case, the insurance companies. So how could you solve this externality problem? Let me give you an example. Let's say you're president of North American Porsche. All right? How could you solve the problem? Well, one thing you could do is you could just put LoJack devices on all your Porsches, right? Then what's the externality problem? An auto thief goes into a garage, and there are two cars next to each other. You've got a Porsche next to a BMW. If these things really deter auto theft, all right, then you know with assurance, 100% probability, that Porsche has a LoJack device on it. But you only know that there's some probability that, you know, less than that, maybe a 5% or 4% or whatever chance that the BMW has a LoJack device on it. So what's the auto thief going to do? He's going to go and steal the BMW rather than the Porsche, if that device really works. In fact, if that's true, maybe we should tax Porsche for putting it on, because we could go and argue that Porsche is creating a negative externality. It's raising the probability that BMWs are going to be sold, stolen, everything else equal, right? Rather than subsidizing, we should put a tax on Porsche for doing that. So, but, you know, you look out there, and Porsche doesn't put LoJack devices on its cars. BMW doesn't go and put LoJack devices on their cars. Rolls-Royce doesn't, Mercedes-Benz doesn't, Jaguar doesn't, Cadillac doesn't. Why don't they do that? I mean, it seems this would be an easy way of capturing these benefits. Now, these devices cost $600 each, but if the claim benefit, when it's internalized, is going to be $5,000, even if it's half that, even if it's a third of that, that's still a huge profit to be made from doing that. Do you think that Porsche is making a mistake, that they're turning down a net gain of $4,400 per car that they could have? I mean, if you think that's the case, maybe we should have the same type of regulatory bureaus we have insurance for the engine size in cars, or for whether they have leather seats. I mean, maybe they're making a mistake on choosing whether to put cloth or leather seats in the car. But presumably you don't think they're making a mistake on that, right? Because if they put in the wrong size engine into the Porsche, or if they put cloth seats when they should be putting in leather seats in the Porsche, presumably you believe they're going to figure that out, because they're going to be losing money. They're going to be driving off customers who are going to go and buy a car from someplace else. And yet, the gains and losses from presumably whether they put leather or cloth seats in the car are probably a lot smaller in terms of the difference than whether they go and, this $4,400 net gain from producing, putting these LoJack devices in the car. And yet, I assume nobody is really concerned about these other types of business decisions that Porsche is making, or that any of these other car companies are making. So you have a question, right? The question is, who has the right incentives to go and try to make this decision, figure out whether there's this net gain of $4,400 that exists per car that's there? And my own gut reaction is that it's likely to be the car companies are involved. But here you have something: the car companies don't do this, the insurance companies don't want to do this type of thing, and yet you've had this regulatory bureau that's claimed, well, LoJack devices are going to be underutilized because we're going to have this externality problem, and therefore we have to mandate that they go and give this subsidy to overcome this claimed externality that exists there. Well, I decided to go and call up some insurance companies and just find out, you know, had they thought about this? You know, was it just some stupid decision that they had made, that they really weren't familiar with the arguments here? Why did they do the types of things that they did? And it turns out, everybody I talked to, I was able to find somebody who had thought about it, had looked at the data, and their claim was there really wasn't much of a gain to these LoJack devices. And the claim was a couple things. One was, even with the LoJack devices, you still didn't get back as many cars as being claimed. But two, when you did get them back, it's often they say you get cars back in a week. Those cars now you're going to be getting back in maybe 2 to 3 days. The problem is, they said they're already completely stripped in both cases when you go and get the car back. Or, you know, you may find a car a week later, it's been taken on a joyride and been in an accident. Well, these people take it on the joyride right away, and it's already damaged and left on the side of the road. It's just they get it back sooner than they would have gotten it otherwise, and they argued, to me anyway, that it just wasn't worth the additional expense to have this device on there to go get them back 4 or 5 days earlier than they would have gotten it otherwise. There just wasn't that much of a difference in terms of the final car that they got back. Let me give you one other type of market failure type problem. That is something I mentioned at the beginning with the prices of pharmaceutical drugs. You know, the claim is that we have price gouging by these pharmaceutical companies, that you know, they're holding up people, making them pay more than they otherwise should for these drugs. Let me give you an example related for a minute, and maybe you can see the comparison. I write books. It may take me a year to write a book. Some people may spend 2-3 years going and writing a book. But you may not know this, but the publishers tell me that for about 90% of the books, it costs about $3 to $5 to pay for the printing costs to go and print up books. And yet you go to the bookstore, and these books that may have cost $3 to $5 to print up go for $28, $30, $35. I mean, talk about outrageous price gouging, right? I mean, there's a simple solution we could have to this problem. We could just allow generic books. People could go and run off copies of existing books that are there and sell them off. And I bet you if we did that, we could drive down the price of books. Maybe, you know, there's some storage costs and handling costs and other things. So, but we probably could drive down the price of books to $7 or $8 rather than this really outrageous price gouging that occurs for books, which are, you know, $28, $30, $35 for these books. But what would happen if we started having these generic copies of these books out there? It's true the price of existing books would be relatively low, right? But what would happen to new books? The cost of printing up the books isn't the only cost of producing them, right? I mean, I've got to spend a year writing a book. If you tell me we're only going to be able to cover your printing costs, and that's what's going to happen. I mean, the generic ones, they're just going to cover their cost of printing up the copies of the book. Am I going to want to go and spend a year for free going and writing up a book? Now, maybe you already feel we have enough books. I mean, there's no way, no matter what I do, I'm going to be able to read all the existing books that are there. And God only knows policy debates just keep on repeating the same arguments over and over again. And so maybe what we could do is we just say, look, you know, this was argued 30 years ago. We've been debate on socialism, and here's some famous books that were written on the debates at that time. And you could go and do that. And, you know, but presumably some people like getting a seventh volume of Harry Potter, okay? They like having some new book, even though there's lots of great fiction that's already there that they can go and read from. But that's the trade-off that you face. You can get all the existing books relatively cheaply, but at the cost of not getting new books that are there. Well, it's the same type of trade-off that you face with regard to drugs. And the issue is essentially, you know, I'll give you an example. You develop a drug in the United States and start selling in the United States. The way WTO, World Trade Organization, works is that for Canada, for example, if you don't start selling a drug within 2 years in Canada, after you start selling in the United States, you lose your patent. And basically anybody can start to sell the drug in Canada. So what the Canadian government does when you're Pfizer, let's say, and you develop a new drug, Canada will say, okay, here's the price that we're going to go and let you sell the drug for. It's something above the cost of, you know, the printing type cost, the cost of stamping out each pill, the marginal cost of producing each pill there. But it's nothing that's going to let you go and recoup, you know, the billion plus dollars in 10 years that it takes to go and develop the drug to begin with. And so you have a choice. You can either accept the price that they're willing to pay you for the drug, or if you say no, then they say fine, they wait the 2 years and let everybody else start to go and produce the generic version of this drug. And so you're essentially held up there because you lose your patent if you don't agree to the offer that they've given you there. And so at least it's better to get something over and above marginal costs there than to get nothing on that. And so when countries around the world make those offers to the drug companies, that's pretty much what they do. And in fact, right now, about 50% of the dollars that drug companies make around the world for selling drugs is made in the United States. I mean, you can go and argue that the other countries are in some sense free riding off the investments that Americans are paying for in terms of developing new drugs. But it also means that presumably next year, when we go and pass price controls on drugs, as seems to be almost assured at this point, and you can already see it, well, we'll get into that in a second, that we're going to, my guess is we're going to see a huge change in the amount of research that's done. But we're already seeing it. And here's the question. Even just talking about price controls means that people 5, 6, 7, 10 years from now are going to die that otherwise wouldn't have died. And I don't know how much stronger to go and phrase it. But think of it this way. Let's say you're some president of a drug company, and some bright young scientist comes running into your office all excited about something that he thinks is going to be able to cure cancer, or at least make existing treatments much more effective. But you know it's going to be 10 years or more before the drug comes out. If you think that there's, let's say, 100% chance 2 years from now price controls are going to be there, you may tell him, look, I got all these development costs with the price regulations. I'm only going to be able to get a fraction, recoup these costs. It's not going to be worthwhile for me doing, even though the price controls aren't yet in effect. But even if the probability of the price controls going on are 50% or 40% or even 30%, there are going to be some projects that you otherwise would have gone forward with that now you're not going to go forward with. And so Pfizer just a week or so ago decided it's going to shut down its drug research division that deals with heart conditions. And I believe if you look over the last year, you're going to see them shutting down, or yet last year and a half, particularly, you're going to see all sorts of drug companies just shedding research teams all over the place. And you know, the problem is with these types of controls is that once they're imposed, they're almost impossible to get rid of. And think of it this way. You go and impose the price controls, and 5 years later, people begin to realize that there are no new drugs coming out. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but there's been no new childhood vaccines produced in the United States in the last 7 years. Now, maybe we already have all the childhood vaccines we want. You know, maybe we don't need more effective ones or new ones that are there. But basically what happened under the Clinton administration is that the government has turned out to be virtually the sole direct purchaser of childhood vaccines. And they've used that power to go and essentially tell the vaccine companies that make childhood vaccines what price they're going to be willing to go and pay for that. And the companies have kind of reacted as you would expect them to. In fact, you may have noticed one of the interesting things was with the bird flu vaccine, how hard it was to go and get vaccine manufacturers to go and make the bird flu virus vaccine. What had happened was when we had the anthrax scare some years ago, Tommy Thompson, then head of HHS, had decided as a cost-saving move, I guess, that he was just going to basically expropriate at cost the vials of the anthrax vaccine that the drug companies had. And they didn't make any money on that. They lost a lot. And so they went to him and said, well, if we go and develop this, how do we know you're not going to go and declare some type of national emergency again and go and take all this bird flu vaccine that we go and produce? And so what ended up having to happen was Congress went and passed some legislation which made essentially, you know, some slush funds available for the HHS secretary to go and pay drug companies to go and try to develop this. But, you know, the nice thing about the market is that the drug companies themselves can try to guess what the demand is going to be for all the different drugs that they can produce and decide which ones make the most sense, where the payoff, where the demand for these things are going to be, rather than having Congress decide or somebody else decide on a case-by-case basis where they're doing. Who, might you guess, is going to do a better job of predicting where the demand is going to be for these types of drugs that occur in the future? Anyway, so again, you know, the point I was making, and it applies to these examples that I just gave, you know, the more costly something is, the less you'll do. But there's lots of examples that we can give on this. You know, you look at something like campaign finance regulations, which have played, I believe, a very major role in the election this fall. You can see, you know, the claims for campaign finance regulation was that it's going to make races more competitive. It's going to make it easier to go and defeat incumbents. It's going to make people more involved in the political system than it would have been otherwise. And yet when you go and look at the data, you find the opposite happened in each of those cases. I just, as a disclosure, I was the statistical expert for Mitch McConnell's side in the McConnell v. Feingold case before the Supreme Court a few years ago. But you know, when you think about it, it's pretty easy to go and explain why you have the opposite happen in these cases. So let's just take one very simple type of campaign finance regulation, and that is something I'm sure you're all familiar with, and that is donation limits. So now it's like $2,300 per cycle that you can give for a federal campaign. Now, the issue here is who is it more costly to go and raise money under that type of system? And the thing is, it's much easier for an incumbent who's been around for a long time, who has a long list of potential donors that he may have put together over 12 or 14 years, to raise a small amount of money from a lot of potential donors than it is for a challenger to go and do that. I mean, just think how difficult it is even to get together a mailing list. I mean, it may take 6, 7, 8, 9 times sending out fundraising letters before the fundraising letters even cover the cost of sending that out. Because you go and send out the letters, the first time you send it out, you know, you got the printing and mailing costs, but just such a tiny fraction of people, you know who you are, respond, know what your beliefs are, that you get such a small response rate, it doesn't pay to do that. Now, it's an investment you could go and argue in your future, but it's not like you can go and send it out on consecutive weeks. I mean, you got to have some period of time between when you ask people for money at one time and you go and you try to follow up and see if you can go and get more money from them at a later date. And it just takes time, takes a large amount of time to even have the list pay for itself. And now you look at things like, you know, so that may help explain why incumbents are, their re-election rates go up. They're basically, or the rate at which they're defeated falls by about half when you have those types of regulations. But you also see the size of the win margin for incumbents about doubles. And you also find at the same time that you see incumbents are more likely to run unchallenged. Now, you take those things together, it's not too surprising that you see fewer people vote then. Because what determines, one thing that affects the rate at which people vote, is how contested the race is. You know, closer races tend to have higher turnouts for them than you have less contested races. And so if you have a situation where you have many more races where you don't even have a challenger, and when you do have a challenger, everybody knows what the result of the race is going to be long beforehand, the returns that people get for going and learning about what's going on there and actually participating in the process decline. Let me give you another quick example, or another example, and that is, you know, you look at the 1970s, and there's some really major social changes that occurred in the 1970s. We saw an explosion in out-of-wedlock births. We saw plummeting by about 70% in the rate at which children being put up for adoption. I mean, you think about it. You know, today everybody thinks about, very common to go overseas to go and adopt a child. If you're not old enough, but I'm sure a few of us are here in the room, that if you remember, you would remember that prior to the 70s, there used to be national campaigns to go and try to get people to adopt children. Because we had so many children in the United States that were looking for homes for adoption. That changed during the 1970s, a dramatic change that happened. During the 1970s, we also saw the elimination of what's called shotgun marriages. These are marriages when the woman would get pregnant out of wedlock and there'd be a lot of social pressure on the man to go and, quote, do the right thing. But all those things kind of combined led to a huge explosion in single-parent families that occurred during the 1970s. And also at the same time, we saw a big increase in the number of abortions. Now you think about these things, and it seems like these numbers are just going in completely opposite directions from each other from what you would expect. If I'm having this big increase in abortions, why am I having this big increase also in out-of-wedlock births? Shouldn't out-of-wedlock births fall when I'm having this big increase in abortions? Or if out-of-wedlock births are soaring, why do I have this massive plummeting of children being put up for adoption? If I have more out-of-wedlock births, shouldn't I have more kids up for adoption than I had previously? So what's happening there? I mean, it seems like these things, and I could give you other major social changes that occurred during the 1970s, but it seems like a lot of these things are just going in opposite directions from what you would expect. And in fact, I think there's a fairly simple explanation that combines these and other social trends that were occurring at the same time together. And that is the liberalization of abortion rules that occurred in the late 60s and early 1970s. Now, you think about it, probably the most obvious effect from the liberalization of abortion rules is on the rate of premarital sex. And we have a lot of evidence that when states liberalized their abortion rules, you would see an increase in premarital sex. We know this not only from venereal disease rates, but we also know it from surveys. And that by itself is enough to give me all the rest of the story that I have. But there's another thing I'll just mention as an aside, and that is there's some. And as, before I go on, as an economist, that's not too surprising, that increase in premarital sex. You know, there are other things that may have occurred earlier. You can go back to 63 and other changes that were occurring. But you see, right at the time when different states liberalize the abortion rules, right at that time, you see these spikes in venereal disease rates and these changes in survey on premarital sex. Now, there's something else that some of these surveys indicate, and that is people were less careful with contraception than they were. You know, both of these things, you have this option now. If something goes wrong, you get an unplanned pregnancy, it's less costly because you can go and turn to abortion as the way of ultimately solving this problem. And it's not too surprising to an economist that you're going to see these types of changes. Well, so you see more premarital sex, and that by itself would result in more premarital pregnancies. You also see less people being less careful, and that also by itself increases it. Now, you would that explains, obviously, in the legalization, a big increase in abortions, but if it's large enough, if you're having a large enough increase in the number of premarital pregnancies, as long as you have some women who just find once they get pregnant that they're unable to go through with having an abortion, you can still get an increase in out-of-wedlock births. The thing is, there's something else that's occurring that makes that effect even much stronger. And that is, imagine this. Imagine you have two types of women there, just to make it simple. Those who know they're willing to go and have an abortion, and those who know that they won't. But what happens when you liberalize these abortion rules? The women who know that they're willing to have premarital sex will have a lot more premarital sex, much more willing to do it now because the cost for them doing it has fallen. But even the women who know that they don't want to have an abortion afterwards, many of those will now begin to have premarital sex simply for competition and kind of the dating market that's there. You know, if you have some women who are much more willing to have premarital sex than you would have had otherwise, these other women are going to feel pressured to go and do some more of the same thing themselves, even though they know they run the risk that if they become pregnant, they're going to have to deal with this pregnancy in a way that's going to be more difficult, let's say, than the women who are willing to have the abortion. Now, the interesting thing is how that explains what happens to out-of-wedlock, happens to adoptions. Because what happened is, prior to the liberalization, you'd have women who had premarital sex, got pregnant, wanted to have an abortion, were unable to do so, and so what do they do then to turn to as the next best way of dealing with this unwanted pregnancy? They go and put the child up for adoption. But there's something different. You have a sorting type problem, if you've taken law and economics. You have a sorting type problem. You have a different type of woman now who's going to be carrying the child to term. Before, the women that you had that carried the child to term wanted to have an abortion but couldn't. Now, you have everybody can have an abortion, and the women who are having the out-of-wedlock births are the ones who consciously chose not to have an abortion, possibly because of some emotional connection or tie that they have to the fetus or child that's in them. And so, for whatever reason, the same thing that seems to make it difficult for certain women to go and have an abortion also seems to make it difficult for them to give up that baby later on when it's born for adoption for somebody else. And so the very time you're seeing this huge increase in out-of-wedlock births, we're seeing this 70% drop in the rate at which children are available for adoption. And you also have this change in shotgun marriages. What's happening there is that you have a situation where, you know, before there'd be a lot of social pressure on the man to go and get married. Now, with the liberalization of abortion rules, it's a woman's choice. And the guy basically goes and says, you know, I think you should have an abortion. And she says, no. He says, well, that's your choice. You know, if you force me, I'll provide financially. Of course, anybody who's had kids knows that that's just a small portion of the cost of having kids. And but he says it's the woman's choice, and he's kind of absolved of the responsibility. And so, but the thing is, all these things, whether it be the increase in out-of-wedlock births, the drop in adoptions, the end of shotgun marriages, all these things implied one thing, and that is more single-parent families. And there's a huge amount of social science research that goes and looks at the investments that kids receive in a two-parent versus single-parent family. And what you find is that children raised in single-parent families trying to control for everything else, to try and make it equal, we find that children raised in single-parent families are much more likely to do poorly in school, much more likely to drop out, are much more likely to be involved in juvenile or criminal activity. You know, the list of things go on. And I would argue one of the things is that not only do you have this lower investment in kids, but you also see this liberalization of abortion rules leading to more crime later on than reducing it, as some have claimed. Now, there are other things I could talk about. There are lots of interesting things about changes in divorce laws, how that impacted the number of kids that people have, you know, decisions for women to go and work as opposed to staying at home. But I'll leave that aside just to talk briefly about this bailout stuff that's been occurring. And just give you some background here, because there's a lot of comparisons that are made to the Great Depression. Anna Schwartz had an interview about 2 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal. Anna Schwartz was a co-author with Milton Friedman of a book called A Monetary History of the United States, which I think most academic economists would regard as kind of the definitive history of kind of business activity and the money supply in U.S. history. And their argument was what caused the Depression was that you had, prior to 1913, banks were able to go and write contracts with their customers that would allow them, if there was a run on the bank, to just delay payment for people. So that, and there were different clauses you could agree to in your contracts, and it would affect the interest rate that they would pay for that, in order to prevent the bank from not being able to fulfill its demands on the deposits and going becoming insolvent and going out of business. With the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, those types of contracts were outlawed. But in exchange for that, the Federal Reserve agreed to act as what's called the lender of last resort, which is that if a bank found itself in some type of liquidity crunch, the Federal Reserve would step in and loan the money temporarily to go and tide them over something like this run on the bank that would be occurring. Well, in 1929, we had a Federal Reserve governor named Strong who believed that the banks were being profligate. When you had some banks that ran into some difficulty, one particularly apt named bank, the Bank of the U.S., that ran into some problems, they turned to the Federal Reserve, asked for the Federal Reserve to serve as a lender of last resort, and the Federal Reserve said, no, we're not going to do that. And there's a run on the bank went under. Now, other people, other banks saw this, and what they did was they said, look, we're not going to be able to go and depend upon the Federal Reserve to go and act as a lender of last resort. So a lot of banks start selling off their assets in order to build up their liquidity to cover demands that may occur on their deposits. Well, when they did that in 1929, we had this drop in the stock market that occurred. And of course, what happened was then a lot of banks that a week earlier had been solvent found that they weren't solvent anymore. And so there's more runs on banks, additional attempts by banks to go and sell off their assets in order to cover it, and you're kind of off to the races. And the problem is that not only did you have these bankruptcies, but if you've taken macroeconomics, you know there's something called the money multiplier, which means that you go and deposit a dollar in the bank loans out 90 cents of it to somebody else, they spend it, they deposit in the bank, and it goes on, and you really, each dollar really creates a lot more purchasing power than just that original dollar. It's this money supply that you have there. And so all these banks going and increasing their reserves that they have in order to self-insure against runs on the banks dramatically lowered the money supply, and reducing the money supply meant that each dollar was worth more in a sense. It's kind of like if I had an apple standard and I had half as many apples tomorrow as I have today, each apple is going to be able to purchase more than it would have otherwise. And so we had this huge deflation that occurred with all the problems that resulted in terms of the Depression. So Anna Schwartz's argument was that a lot of what's happening right now with the Federal Reserve is that they're fighting the last war rather than realizing that there are really some important differences that exist there. Just mention one other thing quickly, and that is another comparison that may be more apt is the savings and loan crisis that happened during the 1980s. I think the vast majority of economists think that what happened was is you have federal deposit insurance, which ironically was something that was started after during the Depression in order to try to create confidence in the banks. But the thing is, what you find with government insurance programs, they seem to have one common feature to them, and that is they charge everybody the same insurance premium no matter how risky the insurance is that you're offering them. So, for example, flood insurance. In the past, it's changed somewhat now. It's still not perfect. You go and build a house next to a river or build it 5 miles away, you pay the same flood insurance rate. And yet, you know, 19 times or whatever, you could have a house rebuilt right next to the river. And if it was a private insurance company, you basically have to charge the guy the value of the house each year in order to insure it, rather than going and offering some low insurance rate, and you're just encouraging people to go and have a nice view while all the taxpayers are picking it up. Well, the problem is, that's pretty much what happened with the savings and loan. Imagine you had two banks next to each other. You had a bank that made safe investments and a bank that made risky investments. But the riskier the investment that you make, the higher the interest rate that you get back. Now, if you have deposit insurance and you're trying to decide which bank you're going to go and put your money into, which bank are you going to put it into? To you, both banks are equally risky, right? And the only thing you care about is the interest rate that you get paid on your deposit. And so what happened is what economists call disintermediation, that is people took their money out of the safe banks and put them into the risky banks there. And so essentially we drove the safer banks out of business. Now if it was private insurance and you had a risky bank with risky assets, you charged them a higher insurance premium, and that would presumably offset the higher interest rates that they're getting on their risky assets. and take away their competitive advantage that they had under the government insurance scheme. And what you had is essentially riskier and riskier investments. You had a situation where if I got a profit, I got to keep it, but if I end up losing money, then the government essentially picked up the losses through this insurance that's there. Now, kind of fast forward for today, there's a few things that to keep in mind. One is we've had, about 5 years ago, we had really major changes in the accounting rules in this country. We had problems with Enron and WorldCom, and you know, we could go and argue whether it's four or five companies. You know, I'm not sure in all those cases there was actually the type of fraud that people were claiming, but let's just say for the sake of argument it's five companies. And you know, there's a lot of flipping of assets, and there's concerns about fraud that were there, many cases understandable and correct. And we had Sarbanes-Oxley, and the SEC was given a lot of regulatory authority to go and set up accounting rules. And among the types of rules that they set up was something called mark-to-market, which in a theoretical sense is fine. The problem is how it was actually implemented in this case. And that is, you essentially go and look at the traded value of an asset. And the problem is, though, if you have thinly traded assets or assets that are very hard to compare, the rules essentially mandated that you have to compare assets that may not be really truly comparable. If you've seen any of these mortgage-backed securities, you'll see literally 200 to 300 pages of fine print detailing exactly what's unique about this particular mortgage, securitized mortgage that's there. So it's really, you know, all these things seem to be just a little bit different from each other. But you end up with a situation where if a bank goes and tries to clear its books of a particular type of mortgage securitized asset, and it dumps it in order to clear it off, all the other banks which are going to be lumped in terms of classified as having a similar mortgage asset, all of a sudden find that those assets are, you know, really marked down in value. And some banks that may have been solvent find all of a sudden that they're not. But there are other things that are important. One was kind of starting in 77 with the Community Reinvestment Act, the notion was we want to go and encourage home ownership by certain people who haven't been able to borrow money. And so the government essentially cross-subsidized loans. They made it so that loans that you may were making profit on in, let's say, relatively well-to-do areas, you would go and take profits from that to go and subsidize loans that you previously wouldn't have made in higher risk, minority, poorer areas. Well, that was one thing, but in the 1990s, this kind of went on steroids. Because in 1992, there was a study done by the Boston Federal Reserve that claimed that there was massive mortgage discrimination. They had a study based on 3,500 mortgages where they claimed that a minority and a white person who had the same financial background who tried to get a loan, the white would be much more likely to go and get it. The problem is it turned out there was a lot of data errors in this 3,500 sample. You know, you had six people, for example, that you'd have a black person whose supposedly net worth was $10 million who was turned down for a $60,000 home mortgage. Well, the problem is, it turns out, is that that person's assets were actually closer to $1,000 rather than to $10 million. It's just somebody in typing in the data had added a few extra zeros onto the numbers that were there. And that there were other errors that were there. And when those errors were corrected in the data, you found, in fact, the opposite result seemed to be the case, which isn't too surprising given the cross-subsidization that you had with the loans. You had riskier loans being given out to certain groups of people than you had previously as a result of that. But the thing is, despite finding those errors, it didn't stop new regulations being adopted by the Federal Reserve. And you can go through and you can read that the Federal Reserve says that it will be taken as evidence of mortgage discrimination if you don't make loans to people because their inability to make a down payment for certain covered groups of people, if you deny them loans based on their credit scores, or if you deny them loans based upon what type of income they're able to put up to help to put up to indicate they can pay the mortgage. So, for example, after that, you had to include as legitimate income income from unemployment insurance or income from welfare payments that people were receiving. So you had a lot of pressure put on, and the thing is, for each violation, the Fed noted that there was a $500,000 fine, plus in any type of civil suit that could result, that the very fact that you turned down somebody for a mortgage because they weren't able to put down a down payment could be taken to constitute discriminatory behavior on your part, because you know, they argued that there was systematic evidence that simply poor people, through no fault of their own and it not related to their credit worthiness, were less likely to put down down payments than others were. Now, and then we have a final part of the puzzle, and that is Freddie and Fannie. And this kind of gets back a little bit to the savings and loan issue that we had, and that is they essentially believed that the federal government was going to cover their losses. And so you had institutions that were leveraged by 30 to 1. And the thing is, the people who bought their securitized mortgages, because they essentially guaranteed these security mortgages. If you had mortgages that went into default, Freddie and Fannie would promise to kind of make you whole on those. And we didn't really care about their inability to pay those things because we believed it was either explicitly or implicitly backed up by the federal government. Now, there are fraud issues that apparently also occurred where in these securitized mortgages they would rate as AAA plus, they would include these high-risk mortgages that we've been talking about. But again, even though many of the people who bought these saw that, they didn't care. And the reason why they didn't care is because there was this promise that these mortgages and the ability to go and pay off these mortgages was covered by the federal government. And so you had a situation, again, just like with the savings and loan, just like the depositors didn't care about the underlying riskiness of the banks that they were putting their money into. The people who were buying these securitized mortgages that were put together by the Fannie and Freddie didn't care, in many cases, what the riskiness of them were. And anyway, you know, you look at this bailout package. I know I'm probably over time, but the you know, one of the things that's frustrating to myself as an economist, I think others, is like nothing in any of these packages. We've had several bailouts and whatever deal with any of these underlying problems. In fact, if anything, they make them worse in some cases. There was a quote about 10 days ago from the new Bush administration official who's going to be overseeing Fannie and Freddie, and he said his solution to the drop in housing prices was to go and subsidize and encourage more house buying by poor people to make it so that they would be better able to get mortgages than they were previously able to get. But even beyond that, you know, there's a basic question about who we should bail out. And it's really hard to think of why, you know, whether it be Lehman Brothers, the discussion there, or AIG, or Fannie and Freddie, why we should be bailing them out. In Fannie and Freddie's case, you read the news stories, and it made it sound like if we don't bail them out, their mortgages are going to disappear. Well, what happened was, is that Fannie and Freddie, they get lots of subsidies from the federal government. They don't have to pay state and local taxes. They're exempt from virtually all the regulations that other financial institutions have to abide by. That gives them a real cost advantage. And it's meant in the past that they pretty much have a monopoly on securitizing certain types of mortgages because of this cost advantage. In the past, they use those monopoly profits to cross-subsidize you know, people getting these riskier loans. They'd give discounts and charge less to people who gave out more of these risky loans. So it's not just the Fed rules that encourage this. And but what you have happening is that the mortgages aren't going to disappear. What would have happened is they would have been resold and purchased by somebody else. So you look at AIG, a lot of the discussion there, well, it's the largest insurer in the country. We can't let them go bankrupt. But it's not like those insurance policies are going to disappear. What would happen is somebody would take them over. We have a well-established bankruptcy proceedings in this country. Those viable insurance contracts would simply be sold off, maybe not all to one company. But, you know, the question is, what objection can be raised to why the bankruptcy system wouldn't have been able to handle those types of things? So I know I've been going on too long, but I could probably talk for a lot longer about that. But the anyway, I appreciate your time, and I don't know if you have time for a couple questions, but I'd be happy to try to take some.